Hello everyone, welcome back. I hope you're excited for this week's Chabura. Just to quickly review what we've accomplished so far and where we got up to last week. We developed the idea that murder is aser, that you're not allowed to murder. And we also discussed how you're not allowed to murder one person in order to save your own life or to save another person's life. And we discussed why was this. It's because either murder is so terrible, so severe, or because you can't play God. We don't know whose life is more valuable. And either we just can't figure out whose life is more valuable, or by definition, everyone's life is inherently of equal value. And we asked the question, which is that, what if it's not one versus one? We know you can't kill one person to save another person. You can't kill one person to save your own life. But what about sacrificing the life of one to save the lives of the many? So that is our next venture. That is what we are going to be embarking on this topic. It's going to be a fascinating topic. And this year is going to be an introduction to that topic. Because before we really delve into it, I just wanted to share several fascinating case studies and to create a framework for our next few year in which we'll be analyzing the sugya in a much greater depth. So let's start with some fascinating case studies. The first case studies we really have discussed so far, which is we're talking about sacrificing the lives of the few to save the lives of the many. So what if the person who you're trying to sacrifice wouldn't have died otherwise? Meaning we're not talking about a case where everyone's going to die and you're kind of giving over a couple of the people who are going to die to save everyone else in the group. We're talking about a case, much like we've been talking about already, which is the person that you want to sacrifice is not in danger. So in the trolley case, the trolley is heading towards five workers, and the person that you want to sacrifice is off on the side. And if you do nothing, he's not in danger. He's not going to die. And the variation of the trolley case is the fat man case, which is the case where instead of altering the pathway of the train, you push a overweight person onto the tracks itself, which creates enough resistance to prevent the train from running over the five people tied down to track. So once again, this overweight heavy person is not in danger until you put him in danger. And there's the classic case in moral philosophy of a doctor who has five patients. And these five patients are going to die. One person needs a heart transplant. The other person needs a kidney transplant. One person needs a liver transplant, a lung transplant. So all in all, he has these five patients and, you know, two kidneys, a heart, a lung, a liver. And he sees a patient coming for a regular checkup. And he thinks to himself, wait a second. This one person has a heart, two kidneys, a liver, along, I can save all five of these people. So in such a case, this doctor wants to kill one patient to save five patients. Now that one patient he wants to kill is not currently in danger. So that's like the classical case. There's a fascinating real life case in the Second World War where there was a German spy ring, which really was consisting of double agents. And they were working for the German government, pretending to work for the German government, but were really working for the British government. And the Germans were bombing Britain. They were bombing England. They were, they would go over night and just drop bomb after bomb after bomb. And one of the propositions in the British parliament, in the British government, it was proposed that these double agents should transmit information to the German military reporting that the rockets had fallen well north of London. And what was the story? What was the logic? The logic was that the Germans would then aim their future rockets significantly south, a number of miles south. And instead of landing over London, which the rockets had fallen over London, the rockets would land over, you know, Kent or Surrey or Sussex or some place that was well south of London, and there would be far fewer casualties. And the question was, this was proposed, and it was placed before the cabinet by Herbert Morrison, the Home Secretary, and Churchill was apparently abroad at the time, so he wasn't there, But the cabinet rejected the proposal. And their svara, their logic, was that they don't have the justification or the right to choose to sacrifice unendangered citizens in order to save others. And that was their claim. Now the question is, they made that claim. It was a very spiritual claim. Like they said, who are we to act as God? Who are we to decide that one man should die because he lives in the South Coast, another man should survive because he lives in London? And that was the view which prevailed, and they didn't end up doing it. Now, the question is, was that right? Should you sacrifice? I mean, war is also a whole different category in halacha, whether war has a different halachic status in terms of the whole notion of a chaybem, according to some shittos, doesn't apply in times of war. Now, the question is, it does not apply only to soldiers, does not apply to whole nations, nation states. A very fascinating topic, but this is a real-life dilemma. And the question, obviously, is, do you ever sacrifice the few to save the many? There was another fascinating case that happened in Israel in 1980. During the first Lebanon War, Israeli forces took over a large building in Tyre. And it served as a central command headquarters. And the building had several floors. And on the ground floor, there was a large room that served as a dining hall. And upstairs were smaller rooms that became offices and barracks. And in a surprise attack, the Lebanese militants drove a truck that was full, was laden with explosives. They drove it right into the building, and the explosion shattered the entire building, destroying the upper floors that collapsed into a rubble of huge cement boulders. And many Israeli soldiers were killed instantaneously upon impact. And others, some of whom could be assumed to be alive but badly wounded, they were trapped under the debris. And the attack occurred during lunch, while lunch was being served. So the thought was that many, if not most, of the building's occupants, most of the soldiers, most of the people working there were on that ground floor. And they were trapped. So the question arose, how could the engineers clear the mass of rubble fast enough to free the soldiers who are trapped below before they die? Their lack of oxygen, food because of their wounds, etc. So at one point it was suggested that they should bring heavy-duty bulldozers to raise the upper levels of debris and thereby hastening the approach to those trapped below, meaning get rid of the entire upper layer, just bulldoze that over and open up room to allow a rescue team to get in and rescue all these people trapped below. But the problem is that they knew that there were definitely some people on those upper layers. And if they bulldozed over all those upper layers, every one of those layers would for sure be killed. So the question was, and it was argued, maybe to save so many, you can just sacrifice those few on top. And I mean, what actually happened was at the end, the idea was dropped, and it wasn't practical. You couldn't end up doing it. But the question was raised and was asked to Rabbanim, and the question became, are you allowed to sacrifice the few to save the many? So this whole genre, and I tried to really clarify this last time because there's so many misconceptions. The reason I'm trying to do this is because we want to create categories. Because without categories, it's all just a bunch of, can you sacrifice life to save life? And you can't really do it like that because there's so many variables in play. So what I want to do is to create categories of, one, can you sacrifice the few to save the many when the person who you're sacrificing or the people you're sacrificing are not in danger or potentially not in danger? So, for example, in the trolley dilemma, in the trolley case, these people were not in danger. In the World War II, these people were not in danger. You could easily, they were likely, the people south of Bryn were not in danger. The doctor wants to kill the patient. These patients, the patient who he wants to kill is not in danger. You can argue, that was the argument that was made in the building in Israel, that the people in the upper floors had a much likelier chance of surviving. And you can argue that they were in danger. It might not be a good case to put in that category. But the point is that they weren't currently in danger. As in, if you don't do anything, they weren't necessarily going to die because they weren't trapped underneath all that debris. And they were much more likely to survive. Now, the second category is where the person might have died anyways. And the argument is that They're not definitely going to die, and you can argue that maybe the Tower case in Israel could fit into that category, but the person might not have died, or they might have died. But that's basically it's a question mark. So what's an example of that? So during the Holocaust, the Germans approached the Judenrat, who were Jews that were put in charge of the Jewish camps, and the Germans told these Judenrat, these Jewish camp leaders, that they had to select a certain amount of Jews who were going to be sent off to the death camps. And what was the ultimatum? The ultimatum was that if you don't select a certain amount of people, either we'll select the people for you or we'll kill everyone. Different ultimatums. It is important what the ultimatum was, but we'll assume for now that it was not a good ultimatum. So a lot of the Judenrat, Romanowski was one of the classic examples, he agreed to select certain Jews from his camp, and he sent them off to the Germans. He sent them off with the Germans on train straight to the death camps. And who did he choose? He chose the elderly, the young, the sick, the woman. And what was his argument? So his argument was that this is correct. Why? Because first of all, better that only they die than all of us die, meaning sacrifice the few to save the many. And he argued that these people were going to die anyways. Or they were probably going to die. I mean, you can't say they're going to die, but they're more likely to die anyways. So better that just these people die than everyone dies. And it was a big question, because you might, be just drawn to say that it's wrong, but was it wrong? Are you allowed to sacrifice the few to save the many? What if the people that you're sacrificing are also in somewhat of a dangerous situation and might be dying anyways? And better that some people die than everyone dies. Or another classic case that happened in the Holocaust was that in the camps they had a rule that if you tried to run away and were caught, that you had to choose another Jew to be killed with you. And it was a crazy, crazy rule that they had, because first of all, the question halachically was, are you allowed to run away? Because if you're caught, then that means that other people are going to die because of you. So we actually talked about this, and the answer might be yes, since Chayecha Kodman, that your life comes first, and you can define that as an act of hatzalah, as saving yourself, not an act of potentially endangering someone else. But we discussed whether or not, when it comes to saving your own life, you could do it even if there will be potential repercussions. And there would also be a big difference between if by definition other people would be in danger because you did it. For example, let's say if you run away, they will kill people, versus if they run away and they catch you, they're going to make you kill someone else. But they had both rules. So let's say if you ran away, other people were going to die. That's a big question. Can you endanger and potentially kill other people's, even though it's not going to be direct because you won't be pulling the trigger, but because of your actions, knowing that when you do this, other people will die, can you do that? Can you endanger other people's lives? So one of the what was the rule? The rule is that if you refused, meaning if they caught you, then you had to choose one other person to kill. If you don't choose another person, then they choose three more people instead of just the one. So either you die, one other person dies when you choose the other person, or you die and three other people die. So what happened? What happened was that 10 people ran away and they were caught. And the question was, can they choose 10 other Jews to be killed? And what will happen is that they'll minimize the amount of death and the amount of people who die. Or do they have to refuse to choose and have 40 Jews be killed, meaning them and 30 others, instead of just the 20 of them and the 10 they choose? So it's an extremely difficult question. Can you kill the few? Actively choose to kill the few who, and remember, these are people in the Holocaust. You can argue that people are dying all the time, so they'll die anyways. But no, they're not going to die right now. So can you kill the few to save the many? And I want to get to the next category, which is not the last category, but it's the next category, which is where, what if everyone's going to die? What if everyone is going to die, regardless of whether or not you choose, and all you're doing by choosing is just you're minimizing the amount of death. In other words, if you do nothing, then everyone in question will die, let's say 500 people. But if you do kill these people, only, let's say, 20 of the 500 people will die, but everyone else from the 500 people will survive. So really all you're doing is you are minimizing death. You are saying that everyone's going to, all these people are going to die. And remember, in the case of choosing 10 people in the Holocaust, you don't know if the 10 people that you were going to choose are going to be chosen by the Germans. Chances are they won't be. So it's not that those 10 people are going to be dying anyways. And those 10 people, they might survive. They might not. I mean, they might be chosen by the Germans. They might not. But the reason why they might have died anyways, because number one, it's in the Holocaust. So people are dying all the time from starvation, from depression, etc. And second of all, the Germans themselves might choose that same person that you chose. So there's a chance that you're not really putting them in danger. They'd be in danger anyways, or they'd be dying anyways. But in the case of 9/11, this is the classic case. There was, we all know that 9/11, there were a bunch of known terrorist attacks that succeeded and that crashed into buildings, but there were other ones that failed. And there was another plane that was hijacked and was heading towards the White House. And the reports claim that the hijacking pilots lost control of the plane, and the plane is recorded to have crashed in open field and failed to reach its target. But the question became, what if the Air Force would have been able to intercept this plane and shoot it down in time before it reached the White House? So according to Halacha, would you be able to kill the terrorists and all the passengers on that plane in order to save all the people who would have been killed if the plane was allowed to crash into its target? So, for example, let's say with the plane crashing into its target, 500 people die, but if you shoot the plane itself, 80 people die or 100 people die. Can you kill the few to save the many? And what's the argument? Number one, you can say that these people are about to die anyways. If the plane crashes into the building, they're going to die anyways. Oh, what about Chaisha? What about the amount of life they have left? What if it's hours? They still have a couple hours left. Is that significant? That's going to be one of the questions. Number two, aren't they a Rodef? They're pursuers. They are endangering everyone else's lives outside the plane. The building that they're going to crash into, you're killing them. So you can argue that they're a Rodef. But one second, the terrorists might be a Rodef or Rodfin because they have horrible intent to kill and murder, but what about everyone else on the plane? I mean, you can say that the fact that they're in the plane and they're now become part of the danger, but really, is that fair to them that they have no intent to do any harm to anyone else, but they're being killed because they are in a flying bomb that's heading towards other people to kill them? So that's something which you really have to think about. There's also a fascinating case that was actually produced in a film, and the case is a fascinating moral dilemma, where there were two ships, and both of the ships had bombs on them. And it was 11 o'clock p.m., and the instructions were that at 12 o'clock, both of the ships are going to explode. Both of them will implode, and everyone on both ships will die. Now, each ship was given a detonation device to the other ship. That if you blow up the other ship, so obviously the bad guy, says that if you blow up the other ship, then your ship will survive. And if neither of you blow up the other ship, then you will both explode at 12 o'clock. And the only catch is that one of the ships had inmates who were all cons, who were all horrible people, murderers, people who stole, who abused, who were drug dealers and whatever. They were horrible people. Now, you can't really say that makes such a big difference because that ship also had cops and security on board. But that was kind of the idea. The premise is that one ship has the scum of the earth, the worst people imaginable on it, and the other ship has just regular civilians. Now, can you blow up the other ship? And you can even forget the account of the the fact that one of the ship has people who are not good people on it, who are, you can even argue, potentially chaimisa, because they also had the cops and security guards. It's just kind of creating this emotional sense of, like, one ship has more of a right to survive than the other. But the question really became, can you sacrifice one of the ships? If you're on the ship, can you kill everyone on the other ship in order to save everyone on this ship? Since if you don't, everyone's going to die. Which is a very similar argument to the 9/11 airplane question. And what ended up happening, actually, just very interesting in terms of the storyline, was that the thug on one of the ships, no one on either ships was willing to pull the plug, and the thug on one of the ships actually said, "Give me the detonator." He said to the cop who had the detonator, "Give me the detonator. I'm going to do what we should have done a while ago." And he took the detonator and he threw it out the window. And neither of the ships blew the other ship up. At 12 o'clock, neither ship blew up. And the bad guy of the film, of the story, was trying to portray the idea that people will save their own skin at the expense of other people and will kill other people to save their own lives. And people didn't do it and proved him wrong, which is a very powerful idea. But we're not going to get into the nitty-gritty of it yet, because we can take a step back and ask from a halachic standpoint, was this definitely sounds very altruistic, but is this actually the halacha? Do you have to potentially give up your life even if both parties will die otherwise? Meaning, it's not like I'm giving up my life so that the other person can survive. It's I'm allowing both of us to die so that neither of us will kill the other person. Another interesting subcategory is what if there's a clear source of danger, like one of the people in the party, one of the people who are going to die is clearly the reason why everyone else is going to die, but there's no intent. So for example, a famous case that occurred at the end of the 20th century was a case where two Siamese twins were born sharing a heart. They shared a 6-chamber heart. And if the twins remained together, they wouldn't be able to live very long, and they'd both die. But if they were separated, then one of them would be able to live a relatively healthy life. That was the assumption. And what they found out was that the 6-chamber heart, 4 of the chambers were in one of the children, and the other child was really just kind of like living off, almost like a parasite, was living off of the other child. Like, he was for sure going to die no matter what. And the child who had most of the 6-chambered heart, who had the 4 chambers, was going to die because of this, of his Siamese twin who was connected to him. And the question was that, are you allowed to kill or separate these two Siamese twins together, knowing that one of them's going to die and one of them's going to survive? So you can say that, oh, it's very clear that the child that has only 2 of the chambers is a rodef, is the cause of the other person's death. But wait a second, how do you define a rodef, a pursuer? We gave a shir on this. This was the second shir in the series. But at the same time, do you have to have intent to be a rodef? Or just the fact that you are the cause of danger itself, is that enough of a reason? You have lots of cases like this. For example, there was a very, very sad story of a man who came over to a Rav after the Holocaust, and he was asking if he can duchen. And why was he asking if he can duchen? Because a Kohen is allowed to duchen, but not if he's a murderer. If a Kohen is a murderer, he's not allowed to duchen. And his question was that during the Holocaust, they were hiding in a bunker, and they heard the Nazis coming. So everyone got quiet, and this Kohen, his little baby started to cry. And he didn't know what to do, so he covered its mouth. And it was more instinctively, but he covered its mouth so that they wouldn't be discovered, and so all, let's say, 20, 30 people in this bunker wouldn't be found and wouldn't be killed. And the baby suffocated. and it was tragic, but he came to ask, am I a murderer? Was this allowed? Was I allowed to cup my hand over this little child's mouth in order to save everyone from being discovered and killed? Clearly, he had regret. He clearly didn't want to do that, but just as a matter of fact, is he a murderer? Was this Asur? Was Asur? And you have, I mean, within moral philosophy, you have all these famous cases of a person who has no intent to harm everyone else, but it just, the case itself makes him the person who's harming everyone else. For example, there's the famous Fat Man Dynamite case, where a group of friends are exploring in a cave, and on the way out of the cave, unfortunately, in a lot of these cases, it's the big man, who went first and he gets stuck in the opening of the cave. And it's trapping everyone in the cave, and the cave, for some reason or other, starts flooding. So the water level of the cave is rising, and everyone's going to drown. Everyone's going to drown. So one person, obviously, has a stick of dynamite and a match. And the question is, can you blow up the opening of the cave, or the Fat Man himself, to save everyone else? So you can argue that he's a rodif, he's causing everyone else to die, so he's chayv miso, or there's a heter to kill him, or whatever. Go back to the second shir where we really discuss this in depth. But for whatever reason, either he's a rasha, or it's as if he did it, or it's to save him from committing murder, or for whatever various possibilities, but you're allowed to kill a rodef, so you should be allowed to kill him. Or you can argue that no, he has no intent. He's not a bad person. It was a mistake. And therefore you can't argue that you can kill him in this case. And I mean, if you want to say like very, very like, you know, get more halachal and nice and practical to people's day-to-day lives, everyone's had a case like this in some form or another, where in school someone did something wrong and the principal or the menahel walks into the classroom and gives an ultimatum to the class and says, either the person who did this step forward, let's say a person cheated on a test or did something that was clearly against school policy, and the principal says, either this person stepped forward or everyone's going to get detention, or everyone's going to, you know, have some consequence that is going to be really bad. Suspension, fail the test, whatever it is. So does the person himself have a chiyuv to step forward and admit it? Can the class hand him over or her over? Let's say they know who did it. Let's say everyone knows who did it, and except for the teacher. Can the class hand him over or her over? Can the class hand over a random, let's say they don't know who did it. Let's say the class has no idea who did it, except for the person him or herself knows. Can the class hand over a random sacrifice to save themselves? Meaning if it's, can they go over to the principal and say, we know who did it, and just hand over one person, and that person will get this punishment instead of everyone getting the punishment? Or let's say, can a tzaddik or a tzaddikas, can they just offer themselves over as a sacrifice and say, I did it? And everyone knows the classic story where the tzaddik or tzaddikas goes up and says, I did it, I'm sorry, I apologize. And you know, like either the principal or the teachers like roll their eyes and say, yeah, of course you did, like we know you didn't do it. Or they actually believe this tzaddik or tzaddikas, and they're about to give the punishment, when hopefully you just hope that the person who actually did it just says, I can't allow this to happen. I raised their hand, I said, no, he didn't do it, I did it. Or you have like this is the classical Spartacus theory of where one person stands up and says, I did it. Another person stands up and says, no, I did it. Another person says, no, I did it. And that's very dramatic. Of course, in that case, I think the principal just can go back to giving everyone the punishment. But you can also say this might be a little different because the cheater did it on purpose. So you can argue that in this case, the cheater might not be like a rodef who has no intent, the rodef who does have intent, because they knew that there would be repercussions, or that or you can say that he just did something wrong and therefore you don't have this, you can't say that intent. You can still argue, though, that the person didn't have any intent to endanger everyone else in the classroom when he or she cheated, or did whatever it did that was wrong. The intent was to, whatever, get a good grade or whatever. It was wrong. But at the same time, it wasn't, I had no intent to endanger everyone else. I didn't think I was going to get caught. So you can definitely argue that. I mean, there was a very similar case in the Holocaust of a Jew who stole bread. And it's really the same exact case. The Nazis rounded everyone up, and he said that someone stole a box of bread. This is the officer, the head Nazi officer, he's barking at them. He says, someone stole a box of bread, and you have 2 minutes to come forward, whoever it was, whoever stole it. And if you don't come over, if you don't come forward and say who it is, then 20 of you are going to be shot. So it's a little different than a class getting to, you know, detention. So does the person have to step forward? Can other Jews hand him over? Because remember, if he steps forward or they hand him over, he's getting shot. Can the group hand over a random sacrifice to save their lives, to save everyone? Or can a tzaddik offer himself over as a sacrifice? You have the same, really the same cheshbon. And you can argue he is a rodif, you can argue he isn't a rodif, because he had no intent to endanger everyone else. He had no intent to get caught. And you can say it doesn't really matter. You can say it does matter. That's a perfectly good argument. And the last category that I would like to just introduce before we begin next week really delving into these sugyas is the cases of abortion. Because this is really the first year of the series we talked about abortion. But there are many different interesting intricacies and cases when it comes to abortion. So one really halacha l'maisa case where this really becomes applied is multi-fetal reduction. So what is multi-fetal reduction? So there are cases where, Rahman al-San, unfortunately, a man and wife are not able to have children. They have difficulty. Either it's a problem with her egg, or a problem with his seed, or a problem with actually getting it to become implanted correctly. It's not staying in the uterine wall. So what happens? Sometimes what happens is that the doctors will create an embryo in vitro in the lab and will implant the fertilized egg, which has the male seed and the female egg, will implant it into the woman and will impregnate her. So sometimes the doctors will put many, many fertilized eggs in at a time, because very often they'll put one or two embryos in and it won't catch and it won't work. So they'll put a bunch in at a time so that hopefully at least one will catch. Now, sometimes what happens is that a bunch catch. And to be honest with you, if you look at the actual science, if this happened, it probably means the doctor messed up. Because, you know, it's very unlikely to happen. And choose to give birth too early, it could be harmful to the mother, etc. But I don't know if any of you ever heard of Octomom, a woman who had literally 8 fetuses in her womb at once. But this happens where sometimes a doctor will do the procedure and a woman can have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, even 8 fetuses in her womb at once. And it's extremely dangerous for her. It's extremely dangerous for the fetuses. None of them will turn out healthy. So what are you supposed to do? Let's say you have a woman who has 6, 7, or even 8 fetuses in her womb. Are you allowed to kill some of them? Are you allowed to kill someone to save the mother? So obviously, yes. If you learn to, if you go back to our first year, the Mishnah Olo says that you're allowed to kill even one fetus. Even if a woman's only pregnant with one fetus, you're allowed to kill that fetus to save the mother. Ayin Shem, you can look there to get back into why and all the deeper explanations, the different lamdas behind it, whether the fetus is not life, we can really just get into the basics. So if a fetus is alive, that's the whole question. Is a fetus life? Is a fetus not life? Is abortion murder or is abortion not murder? So if you think a fetus is alive, then you have to say, why are you allowed to kill the fetus to save the mother? You can either say that the fetus has a unique relationship with the mother, being that the fetus is dependent on the mother, or you can argue that the mother is more of a life, or you can argue that the fetus is a rodef, is endangering the mother's life, and therefore you can kill the fetus to save the mother. Now, it gets a little complicated because, okay, but the mother's also a rodef after the fetus, because the fetus is trying to kill the mother, the mother's trying to kill the fetus. So that was Rav Moshe's Chiddush, which says that when you have two rodefs, when you have two rodefim who are after each other, and one is an ikar rodef and one is a tafel rodef, meaning one rodef is more of a rodef. So in the case of the mother is more alive than the fetus. So in that case, the fetus's redifa is mevatel, knocks out the mother's redifa, and therefore only the fetus is rodef, and therefore the mother, therefore you're allowed to kill the fetus of the mother. So that's all if you think that the fetus is alive. If you think the fetus is not alive, then it's not an iser deraisa of ritzicha to kill the fetus. To save the mother's life, you could do it. And remember all different options for what abortion is. Either it's chavala, shechazera, or it's stealing, or it's, iser derabanan. There are lots of different possibilities. And so now the question becomes, but what if in this case, where you have multi-field reduction, are you allowed to kill some of the fetuses to save some of the other fetuses? So if you think it's murder, it's a little more difficult. Because are you allowed to kill the lives of some to save the lives of others? Because if you think it's derabanan, if you think the fetuses aren't alive, then for sure you can sacrifice lives that aren't full yet, meaning it's not murder, to save potential life. Chilul Shabbos acha kedei lishmor Shabbos os harbe, violate something now to prolong potential possibilities. This idea of potential. But, and then the question really becomes philosophically, even if it's mutter, how many should you kill? Let's say you have six. So if you kill two out of the six fetuses, you have four left, it's still pretty dangerous. If you have three, it's still questionable. If you have two, then there's a good chance they'll both survive. So what do? How many do you sacrifice? As little as possible, as many as possible, somewhere in the middle, some sort of balance. So that really is a fascinating question in regards to if we do view a fetus as a full life, and it would be ritzicha, or at least as much a full life as it could be, and it would be ritzicha, then is it allowed? Are you allowed to sacrifice the lives of the few to save the many? Because otherwise they're all going to die. If you think it's not a full life, then how many do you sacrifice? And even if you think it is a full life, you're still probably going to be allowed to sacrifice some of them to save the life of the mother. You might not be allowed to sacrifice some of them to save the lives of the other fetuses, since they're more of an equal playing field, but to save the life of the mother, it seemingly would be allowed. And, I mean, you had a very similar, this is really how we started off the first Chabura, but the case in the Holocaust where the Nazi doctors were killing all pregnant women because they didn't want pregnant women to be in the camps. They didn't think it was, it was a place where they wanted them to be. They couldn't, whatever their cheshbon was, whatever their calculation was, they were killing all the pregnant women. And one doctor, a Jewish doctor, basically went around and just aborted every pregnant woman's fetus. And the story was that he wanted to save the Jewish mothers. So you can now ask the question, was this mutter? Was this mutter? And you can basically go back to the question that we just said. Is a fetus a full life? If it's not a full life, then to save a life, it would be mutter. If it is a life, then why would you be able to kill the fetus to save the mother? Now, what about the Mishnah Olos? So you can argue that Mishnah Olos is referring to what? A case where the fetus is, one option is that the fetus, you could kill a fetus to save the mother because the fetus is dependent on the mother, the mother's life takes precedence. The other option, like that we argued that the Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks, according to the Rambam, that the only reason you're allowed to kill a fetus to save the mother is because they're both a rodef, and the mother's redifa is knocked out by the fact that the mother's more alive than the fetus, and therefore the fetus is a rodef. Maybe that whole idea only applies when the reason the mother is in danger is purely because of the fetus. But like, for example, let's say the woman is going to die in childbirth or die during pregnancy because of the pregnancy itself or because of childbirth. But in this case, is the child, is the fetus really the source of danger? Or perhaps you can argue that the child isn't really the source of danger at all. It's purely the Nazis who are the source of danger. They're the ones who are going to kill. Now, you could conceptualize and say, no, because the Nazis are going to kill a pregnant woman and because the fetus is now defining her as a pregnant woman, it is now the fetus that is creating the danger within, like, this more... Yes, there is a more holistic perspective, which is that, okay, it's being caused by the Nazis, but if you are able to really zone in and focus on, okay, but where does she... get this now status of being in danger, it's because of the fetus. You could argue that it's the fetus that's endangering the mother. You can easily argue the opposite and say that no, the Nazis are the source of danger. They are the road femme. And you have cases like that where a pregnant woman is, let's say she has cancer, unfortunately she's going to die unless she has chemotherapy. But to do the treatment, either the treatment's going to kill the fetus or they want to abort the fetus beforehand. So you can argue that the fetus is not the source of danger here, and the cancer is the source of danger, so you're not allowed to abort the fetus to save the mother. You can, though, argue that you can conceptualize it again and say, because the mother needs the treatment to save her life, and because the fetus is preventing her from getting the treatment, the fetus now becomes a rode from the source of danger. We talked about this, and these are really fascinating issues, and you can give a whole share in each one of these cases. The reason why I want to give this share, and it's a very different share than we usually do, is I just want to create a framework and break down all the different types of cases that we're going to be thinking about. Because on the one hand, we're going to be talking about sacrificing the few to save the many, where, like the trolley problem, the person who you're trying to kill is not in danger. And then we're going to talk about cases where the person you're trying to kill might be in danger or is in clear danger, such as the 9/11 case, such as cases where everyone's going to die unless you kill these few people. And that's going to be the famous Ushami that we deal with soon. That's really the heart of the sugya. At the same time, we need to recognize the fact that the concept of rodef will be important, but we need to think about whether, number one, what it takes to become a rodef. For example, do you need intent, do you not need intent? And just how important rodefa really becomes. And whether, really, are you ever allowed to kill the few to save the many? So that's going to be the next year where we're going to analyze this from a much more halachic perspective in terms of, are you allowed to sacrifice the few to save the many? Is it ever allowed from a halachic standpoint? Have an amazing week, and I am really looking forward to next week's shiur.